When you have to stop but don't really want to, stop at BP. Because BP has everything you need to keep it going. Fuel to keep the adventures going. The BP Me app to keep the savings and the commutes going. Snacks and drinks to keep the crew going. And the BP Me Rewards Visa to keep the rewards going and going and going. A stop at BP isn't a stop at all. Keep it going.
This episode of Writing Excuses has been brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends. If you would like to learn how to support this podcast, visit www.patreon.com/writingexcuses. Season 19, Episode 26. This is Writing Excuses.
Bringing falconry into writing.
15 minutes long.
Because you're in a hurry.
And we're not that smart.
I'm Mary Robinette.
I'm Dong Wan.
I'm Dan.
And we are joined today by our special guest, Krista Hong Edwards.
Hi, I'm Krista Hong Edwards. I'm a falconer here in Utah, and I also happen to be an English teacher. And so the opportunity to be on Writing Excuses is combining my two loves. I'm very excited to be here.
We met Krista in 2023 when we ran the Writing Excuses Bear Lake, where we were doing animal husbandry and we had horses and falconry. She came out with her peregrine falcon Sky and several other birds and introduced us to the wonderful world of falconry. We wanted to bring that to a wider audience, so we invited Krista to come and join us in talking about how to bring falconry into your writing. So when you are, like, first of all, how do you become a falconer? Like,
yeah, that's always the first question that's asked when people see this predatory bird on my arm and they look at her talons and her hooked beak and they want to know, why do you want that thing on your arm? And how did you get that thing on your arm? And it's quite an intense process, but once you break it down, it's a step-by-step process. And so here in the United States, you have to check off three items, I guess you might say. And depending on your state, it differs in the order in which you can do this. But the first thing you need to do is pass a 180-question test that is administered by your Department of Wildlife or Fish and Game Division. After you've passed that test, you then have to secure what is called a sponsor or a mentor, really. Someone who's been practicing falconry for a number of years who agrees to kind of take you under their wing, so to speak, and train you in this very historic and ancient art. And then at that point, after you have your sponsor who's agreed, yes, I'll train this person, you can get your equipment and your facilities inspected. So it's verified by the Fish and Game Division that you are qualified and that you have all the necessary equipment. It's safe for the bird and it's appropriate for the bird. And then at that point, you can get your license. So it takes quite a while.
So I'm curious, what brought you specifically to this? Like,
yeah.
How did you end up becoming a falconer and what was your journey?
Oh, it all started with books, right? It always starts with books. So there's a book, it's relatively well known. Quite a few people have read it in school. It's called My Side of the Mountain.
I was wondering if that's what you were going to pick.
Oh, yes. Yes. And I would honestly say about 75% of American falconers will credit Jean Craighead George, the author of that book, with their own falconry journey. If it wasn't Jean Craighead George, then it was T.H. White's The Goshawk.
Uh-huh.
There's quite a few falconry-related books out there that exposed individuals who wouldn't normally know that this is something you can do into the world of falconry. And so when I was about, I don't know, 7, 8, probably a little too young to be reading that level, but I saw the bird on the cover and I said, I have got to have this book.
Mm-hmm.
And I read it and I realized, oh, that's a thing? I, like, beyond just my parakeet, which I had at home, I can have a peregrine falcon? And so I told my parents, I'm going to get a peregrine. And they said, oh, not when you're living under our roof. And so I moved out, came out here to Utah, which happens to be a great paradise for raptors, which means it's also a great paradise to practice falconry, and started my journey here.
Did you have a question?
I was just laughing at the implication that you moved out of your parents' home at 8 years old because you had a peregrine falcon.
No. At 8 years old, I had determined I was going to get a peregrine falcon. At 18, I moved out to Utah. I'm originally from New Jersey, where it's quite industrial, right? Mm-hmm. And so I knew I wasn't going to be able to pursue my journey there with a peregrine.
We got some raptors out there, but not exactly for this purpose. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So when you were talking about it, you said 180 test yes. question mm-hmm. test, 180 question test. I'm kind of curious, like, what sort of things do you need to know before you acquire a bird?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the test is really just to test your basic knowledge. And the test goes over husbandry, it goes over health, it goes over laws, vocab. So for example, the word caste in falconry could mean one of four different things. Hmm. Do you know the four different things it could possibly mean? What are they? It could mean to restrain the bird. It could mean the bird's pellet that it's coughing up. It could mean the action of bringing the pellet up. It could also mean, this one, I don't understand why, it could also mean a group of birds that you're hunting together. So if you have like two or more falcons or two or more hawks, it's a caste of hawks.
Huh.
So it's, and they're all spelled the same way.
Of course they are.
Those are four very diverse meanings.
Right?
Well, two of them are related, but the other ones, yeah.
But the other ones don't, yeah. Yeah. And again, I don't know how this vocab started, but it's been used for eons, you know, back in the medieval times, they were using a caste of falcons and we still use it today.
So these questions that you have to do, how national or local is this test? Is someone in one particular state going to find a completely different process than what you just described?
Well, not a different process, but the test questions themselves may differ.
Oh, okay.
Because each state's laws are different. So you might be able to purchase the California Hawking Club's study guide, but that will but the legal part of that will only apply to California. And so if you try to take that legal part and then let's say you're testing in Kentucky, you're going to fail that section of the test.
I remember you saying at the workshop that some states you can only hunt birds that are not native to the region, and others you can only have birds that are native to the region. Is that?
Yeah, so each state also has restrictions on what species you can have. So for example, here in Utah, we actually have a wide variety of birds that we can access. Some that you would never actually want to hunt with because they're not exactly great birds to build a partnership with.
Such as
like the Northern Harrier. Mm. It's a really cool looking bird. Look
what
it up.
What a beautiful bird, yeah.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah.
But no one's ever hunted successfully with it because they're just not wired to work with humans the way a red-tailed hawk is or a peregrine falcon is. Mm-hmm. Then meanwhile, you go out to, I think it's Connecticut, and you cannot have an American kestrel there, which is interesting because that's one of the most common starting birds here in the American West. Mm. So each state has its own laws and restrictions as well.
Where do you get a bird?
I love that question because people are like, I go to Petco and I don't see these things for sale.
Seems like that's not
No, it's not the norm, right? So there's two main ways you can get a bird of prey. Here in the United States, we actually have the privilege of being able to trap one from the wild. And a lot of people at first are like, oh, no, wait, why do you want to trap one from the wild? It's actually beneficial to the raptor population because about 70 to 80% of them in their first year will not make it to their second year because the winter is harsh. And if you don't catch something on those cold nights, you might not make it to the next morning. And so we are able to take first year birds, not anything from the breeding population. That's actually illegal. But a first year bird that is going through its first molt, we are able to take from the wild and train for falconry. Alternatively, you can also get one from a captive breeder.
And so Skye, your peregrine.
She's captive bred.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What are kind of some of the sensory details that you think about when you think about Skye in
that
particular?
Is such a good question. And I would say for me, it's the journey of being with her. When I am flying her and this is something that a lot of falconers will talk about. It's a very ethereal experience to be out in the wild with this animal that should not want a partnership with you because they can survive on their own. They know they can, but they keep coming back home with you because they trust you and they feel that connection and that relationship. They don't feel love for you. It's all food-based. I often joke when people are like, how do you get her back? I'm like, same way I get my boyfriends to come back, I offer them food, you know? But you build this relationship with them. And so sensory details that I would start to describe, when she's on my arm, I can feel her talons. And I try to use a lot of falconers and a lot of people at first, they think I want the thickest glove possible to protect me from those talons. I like to use the thinnest glove possible so I can feel exactly what she's thinking and feeling, and I can feel each talon unlock, and I can feel her put pressure on one foot versus the other. So I know a moment before she's going to fly. I know seconds before she's going to tell me that she's satisfied by ruffling her feathers. And there's that very direct connection where she can also feel my muscles tensing, or she knows my cue of, hey, we're ready to go, right? Mm-hmm. So I'll shift my wrist just so slightly so she's leaning more forward and she knows, okay, now we're ready to move on. And then, you know, when I'm touching her, and it's not necessarily recommended that you touch your falcon, but for medical purposes, right, I like her to be used to my touch. I can reach under her wing and just feeling how the feathers overlap each other. They're like dragon scales, right? It's just a very beautiful thing of nature to look at her, the armor kind of on her feathers, on her wings, and how each one perfectly overlaps. And then when she molts, seeing the new ones grow in. And when she molts, it's actually a really beautiful thing because her feathers become more sun bleached as the year passes on. And so then she gets these dark blue new feathers each year. And it's just, I don't know how to describe it. It's a work of art.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. That sounds incredible.
Yeah. Having met Sky, I was just, she is a lovely, lovely bird.
She is. She's got a great personality. You can see in her eyes that she's thinking, she's processing, she's really understanding, you know, even when she's not on my glove, if she's on Mary Robinette's glove, she looks at Mary Robinette, she understands, oh, this is still a safe place. She knows that she's comfortable here.
Well, speaking of safe and comfortable places, let's pause for our break.
Find all your 4th of July needs at low prices, all in the Kroger app. Get USDA Choice bone-in tender ribeye steaks for $7.99 a pound with a digital coupon. Limit 5, then buy 2, get 3 free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I think you have a recommendation for us.
Yes, I do. So if you're looking into writing realistic animals, a book that I really loved was this one called Cher Ami and Major Whittlesey by author Kathleen Rooney. And it's about a pigeon. I don't know how else to describe it, but it's the true story. It's based on a true story of a real war pigeon in World War I. And a lot of people, when I tell them, like, guys, it's about a pigeon and the pigeon's handler, they're like, wait, really? But Kathleen Rooney wrote this book so well, and she wrote the pigeon character so well that you can't help but fall in love with this pigeon and her story. And it's just such a beautiful example of narration from an animal's point of view and her handler's point of view. And again, a lot of people are like, really? A pigeon? A street rat? Like, Are you really plugging this book? I promise you won't regret it. Everybody I've recommended it to falls in love with pigeons as well, much to their chagrin.
And the title of that again was?
Cher Ami and Major Whittlesey.
Sounds amazing. So now that we're back from the break.
I have a question that I've been thinking about, which is, you know, when we started this conversation, you talked about how you got into falconry from, you know, reading Jean Craig at George, and then you mentioned the T.H. White. One of my favorite books is H.S. for Hawk. Yes. One of the things that's so interesting about H.S. for Hawk is it is in part an examination of T.H. White's book and sort of a critique of it in a lot of ways. So I'm kind of curious, from your perspective, what are the things you see in fiction, whether that's books or movies or whatever it is, that you're like, ooh, that's not right. That's not how this works, or is frustrating to you in one way or another?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So I can always tell when an author has really done a deep dive in trying to understand a bird of prey or a falconer's life. And something that I think a lot of authors want to skip over when they're writing fiction is the husbandry aspect of taking care of the animal that their main character, that their protagonist has in their possession. But what they're missing there is that it's the husbandry part that really builds the relationship between the character and the animal. I mean, you think about your pet dog, right? Your dog just doesn't decide it loves you one day and it's going to come home. It's going to come back home with you every day. But it's when you're feeding it. It's when you're training it. It's when you're really, you know, taking it on walks and spending that mundane time with it. And I wish that more fiction writers, again, you don't have to spend, you know, chapters on the training, mm-hmm. but that you touch on the husbandry aspects to make it more realistic and more authentic. And that way, I think you're also doing more justice, not just to the character, but also to the animal as well.
Mm-hmm. After we took the class in 2023, one of the things that I read was Fonda Lee's The Untethered Sky, which I keep telling.
I just ordered it. My house right now.
It's so good.
It just arrived today.
But one of the things that I love about it is so much of the front part of the book is the husbandry aspect. Mm-hmm. It is the bonding with the bird and just the daily aspect of like, you have to clean a lot of bird poop.
Yes, yep. Every day.
Yeah.
You know, these kinds of things and making sure to include this kind of detail in your books has a real world effect. Like, how many kids got owls after they read Harry Potter with no clue of how much work it was going to be mm-hmm. and no actual love of taking care of birds? It's important to depict this kind of stuff.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, in the United Kingdom, there's no laws preventing just the purchase of an owl from the general public. There's no licensing process over there. And so that was actually something that, you know, naturally occurred as Harry Potter grew in popularity, as kids started asking for owls for Christmas. And if you watch the movies, you'll see that Hedwig is kept in a relatively small cage.
Yeah.
People don't know what is actually appropriate for these owls. And it's still a question I get today. Do owls carry messages? No. Yeah. Yeah. You get a pigeon for messages.
Yeah.
But nobody actually wants a pigeon until they read Cher-Ami and Major Wilsey.
Something else that you said as we were getting ready to record this about writing, and we're so lucky because you also are a writer,
mm-hmm.
so you understand the craft of it. But talking about writing animals and honoring the fact that they are animals.
Yeah.
Yes.
What, like, if I wanted to honor the fact that I had a falcon mm-hmm. in a story, what are some things, the things that you see that are anthropomorphic and the things that falcons do that are, like, body language that
yes.
is very specific to them. Like, I remember you talking about something on Skye's face that fluffed when she was happy.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What you're referring to is it's the chin beard.
Yeah.
So they have these little feathers underneath their beaks. And when they're happy, they start to fluff them out. And if they're really happy, their eyes turned almond shaped. And this was actually something I didn't know until maybe 2 years ago. And I've been a falconer for 7 years.
Wow.
And there's all these little secrets, again, that the general, you know, author writing about a falcon may not know, and you don't necessarily need to know. But as you deep dive more into these cultures of animals and animal characters, and you build relationships with people who are familiar with your animal character, you can start to learn this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's doing honor to this animal and being realistic with it.
Yeah.
I think if you're going to anthropomorphize an animal, if it's obviously fantasy, right, then that's one thing. But if you're trying to write something realistic, then honor the animal by making sure it is actually acting as an animal.
Mm-hmm. What does Skye do when she's cranky?
Oh, she lets you know. She has those talons and she has that beak.
Yeah.
Usually she's not cranky as much as she's hungry.
Hmm.
And so
I get hangry. I mean, I get
right,
it.
Hangry, yes. And so she'll just let me know that she's feeling quite hangry,
mm-hmm.
Usually in the form of bobbing her head, looking around for her food, maybe starting mm-hmm. to open her wings, as in, I'm ready to fly right now. But she's never actually been aggressive, and that's rare. I wouldn't say all falcons are this gentle.
Mm-hmm.
She just happens to be one that is very tame and mellow, and every now and then she'll remind me she's a wild animal.
Mm-hmm.
What are some aggressive behaviors you've seen in other birds?
In other birds. Yeah, so there's one thing called mantling that they'll do, and that's actually a sign that they don't really trust the situation, or they might not trust a certain person around them, or they might not trust a dog or even their falconer occasionally. And what it looks like is they will bring their wings out and cover their food. And that's basically them saying, This is my food. I caught it, and I think someone's going to try to steal it. They do it in the wild when they catch prey. And usually it's because they want to hide their food from other soaring predators, other hawks or eagles. But a falconry bird doing that is quite unusual because you want to see that it's trusting of the situation. It trusts its falconer to keep it safe.
I had read about mantling and noted that when we went out with Skye, that she was she wasn't doing that so much. There was there was one point when someone came up by the side of her and I saw her wing go out and I was like, oh, I've read about that.
No, that's totally true. That was the one time I noticed it as well. And if you watched, you might have noticed me shift her so that she didn't feel uncomfortable with that person behind her.
Yeah.
Because it's true, right? She's a bird of prey. She recognizes that, oh, if somebody's behind me, I can't watch this person. So I'm going to cover my food. And so the goal of the falconer there is just to reassure her, no, you're safe, you're fine. Let's move you so that you can see everybody in the group and there's not one person behind you.
What's the thing that you wish the general public understood better about raptors in general? Like, what's the thing that, like, if you could make sure that everyone in the United States was aware of this fact? I mean, do you have a sense of what those things might be?
So many.
I know.
Where do I start?
We're only 15 minutes long, so.
Only 15 minutes long. Okay, let's keep this fast. Fast as a falcon. So I would say just to understand that they are a core part of our ecosystem. And the way that we as humans can impact that ecosystem, we became very clear that we were doing a lot of harm to them in the 1970s with DDT. And we've done a lot better since. However, there are still people out there that are inadvertently and accidentally hurting these birds with, you know, rat poison. And with persecution out in the American West, some people will shoot them because they think that, you know, oh, they are trying to eat my chickens, things like that, right? There's ways to coexist with these animals peacefully in a way that doesn't harm you, your own land, and the birds themselves.
Yeah. Where I live in New York, the poison is such a huge issue.
I'm sure.
Especially, you know, getting into the fall, a lot of the larger raptors really struggle.
Yeah, and that's true because, you know, as the temperature drops, there's less prey, and so they're starting to get more desperate.
Yeah, it's really heartbreaking. Well, we have so enjoyed having you here on the podcast with us, and thank you for sharing all this incredible wealth of knowledge and firsthand experience. Is there anything you want to promote in terms of your own organization or social media? Where can people follow you and find out more?
Yeah, for sure. Again, you know, being an English teacher, I love talking about writing and I love making connections with writers. So if anybody has any questions about writing realistic birds, or perhaps if they want to get in contact with a falconer around them, I have lots of contacts all over the world and I'd be happy to share those. So my Instagram is Krista Feather, all one word, K-R-I-S-T-A, and then Feather. Give me a follow, send me a message. I'd love to get in touch with you. If you're local to Utah, I also do educational raptor experiences. And so you can send me an email at feathersforethought, and that is spelled the exact way it sounds, at gmail.com. or you can also, again, get in touch with me on social media on Instagram.
I highly recommend following Krista because there are a lot of really beautiful photos of her with Skye, and then like just randomly, don't mind me, I'm just holding this golden eagle that's like half the size of you.
Yes,
they are so big.
Oh, they're terrifying too. They're so majestic, and if once you trust them not to hurt you, you feel really good. But in that moment, you're like, what are you gonna do with me?
Absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
So what about your writing? Is that something people can go out and find and read?
Yes. Yeah. So I've published a few articles, mostly falconry related, as well as some personal memoir, short memoir, falconry related articles. So there's a great magazine called Pursuit Falconry. It's published over in the UK and they kind of collect stories from falconers all over the world. I've published several there. There's also another magazine called Hawk Chalk. Published here in the United States. And that one also publishes short stories and memoir and articles based on falconry. So if you're interested in, again, learning more about what this is and what it looks like, those two magazines would be a great one to give a shout out to.
Those are always some of my favorite things is reading a specialty magazine. And I'm also going to say for writers that if you're thinking about writing falconry, when you pick up one of these magazines, don't just read the articles. Actually read the advertisements as well. Because that is going to teach you so much about the things that go into the job and the lifestyle. Because it is
that
a
is
lifestyle.
A great point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is a lifestyle. It's an addiction.
Actually, can you, before we go to homework, can you tell people what the what care and feeding of Sky is like? Because you all talked about this and I was just like, oh, that's not like having a dog.
Oh no, yeah. With a dog, you know, you just pour out some food, it eats it, the end, goodbye. With feeding a raptor, it's quite intense. Some of the individuals that came out for our demo the other day got to see me taking apart her food. And again, they're predators. And so we like to give them the best possible food for them. I compare it to giving the best gas to a Ferrari. Mm-hmm. And so she eats a high quality diet of quail and dove and pigeon. We try to mimic something that she'd be eating in the wild. And so she will eat the whole prey, but she will not eat the whole prey in one sitting. And so I, the falconer, have to cut up that prey to make it more manageable for her. And so that's part of the feeding routine, the care routine. You know, I'm always cleaning up after her. She lives a very spoiled life. I am just her servant. She's really, you know, the master of the house. And so anyways, it takes, I would say it's about 1 to 2 hours every day dedicated to her. If we're out flying and hunting, then it's quite a lot more. It could be upwards of 5 hours a day. Occasionally, if I'm doing a weekend trip, it'll be all weekend we're out hunting.
Wow.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Going out with you to watch her free fly was really a very special experience.
Truly.
I'm glad you guys enjoyed it. Yeah. I love sharing my little corner of the world with people.
Yeah. Actually, I keep saying, and then we're going to do homework, but I do have one. This is, I promise this is going to be my last question. Mm-hmm. On her non-flight days, does she have enrichment activities? Like what?
Yeah.
What does a falcon do for fun?
That's a good question. So she, I mean, her enrichment is really just kind of observing the world around her. Mm. Falcons aren't like parrots where they need constant companionship. They're naturally solitary animals. And so I bring her to work with me sometimes. And
fun.
Yeah. And she has her own spa. She has her own perch. And so she hangs out, watches the students. Occasionally I bring her over to my friend's house and he has a great outdoor space for her to enjoy and watch the world pass. And so on non-flying days, she really is just quite happy to take a break, I would say.
That's fantastic. Well, speaking of a break, you don't get one because you get some homework, which Krista has for you.
Yes. So we're going back to falconry and writing, of course. And so my homework for you would be to really try to, if you want to write a falcon character, or if you want to write about any animal character in general, try to find somebody who is intimately connected with that animal, right? And so if we're going back to falconry, contact your local falconers club or association. A lot of times you can Google, Tennessee Falconers Association or Tennessee Hawking Association. And most of the states will host meets or club events every few months. If you're not able to get in contact with a actual falconer nearby, there's great memoirs out there. Helen McDonald's H's for Hawk is a great example, as is Dave Warren's Onwards, which was actually just published last week. There's a lot of great falconry content, and these writers give you a great glimpse into their life and into their relationship with their animals.
Sounds amazing. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, and thank you.
For our listeners, you are out of excuses. Now go write. Writing Excuses has been brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends. For this episode, your hosts were Mary Robinette Kowal, Dan Wells, and Dong Wan Song. This episode was engineered by Marshall Carr Jr., mastered by Alex Jackson, and produced by Emma Reynolds. For more information, visit writingexcuses.com.